Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I make this show for you, and I hope that you really enjoy it. I have a lot of people that ask me how they can support the show financially, and you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/preacherboys. You're going to get access to exclusive content, including early releases of episodes. I've got a couple episodes right now that have been released at least a month early over on Patreon. You've got access to things like unique merch, depending on what tier you join, and you get access to some behind the scenes content that I'm posting within the group. So head over to patreon.com/preacherboys and become a member over there today. Every single supporter helps make this show a little bit more possible, especially as I continue to add additional episodes and content every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. To find more information about the Preacher Boys podcast and upcoming documentary, visit PreacherBoysDoc.com or connect on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
Have you ever read a book that just left you thinking nonstop for the next few months? Like every time you're in a conversation or every time you're watching something, parts of that book keep coming back to mind over and over and over again. That's exactly what happened after I read Amanda Montell's book, Cultish. Amanda Montell is a writer, language scholar, and podcast host from Baltimore, and she's the author of two critically acclaimed books, Cultish, The Language of Fanaticism, an indie bestseller about the language of cults from Scientology to Soul Cycle, and Word Slut, a feminist guide to taking back the English language. Amanda's books have earned praise from the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, Time Magazine, Harper's Bazaar, and Kirkus Reviews, among others. And Amanda is currently developing Word Slut for television with FX Studios, serving as creator, writer, and executive producer. She's also the creator and co-host of the hilarious comedy cult podcast, Sounds Like a Cult. As a reporter and essayist, Amanda's writing has been featured in Marie Claire, Cosmopolitan, Teen Vogue, Refinery 29, Dame Magazine, The Rumpus, and Who, What, Where, where she formerly served as the features and beauty editor. She holds a degree in linguistics from NYU and lives in Los Angeles with her partner, plants, and pets. You can find her on Instagram with the handle @Amanda_Montell. You guys really want to check out her book. Definitely head to the link in the show notes. It destroyed my brain. That is not an understatement. It changed the way that I listen to language, the way that I perceive conversations, and it is just phenomenal. You're going to get a taste of that in today's interview, where we discuss the language that cults use to manipulate people. Definitely listen to the entire episode. Grab a copy of Amanda's book and go follow her stuff. Check out what she's doing. She's absolutely incredible. But without further ado, here's my interview with Amanda Montell. Amanda, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk with you because your book, people in my group know I've been talking about it nonstop. And it really focuses in on the language of fanaticism. And all of your work seems to be centered around the words that we use and how important they are. Why are words so important?
Well, language is the fabric that makes up our reality, right? It's everything. Without language, we have no community shared beliefs. We have no cults in general. It's it's wildly taken for granted because language is invisible and seemingly commitment free. You know, we grow up with axioms like sticks and stones will break your bones, but words can never hurt you. And that causes us really to overlook the true material power of language to influence our worldview, to encourage conformity and shut down independent thinking, to coerce, to condition, all of the things that a cult really needs in order to gain and maintain power. I've been interested in language ever since I was very, very little. Who knows why? Some combination of nurture and nature made me just a very wordy human. And language has always been the lens through which I see, or I guess hear, the world. I've always been interested in how language works to help a person craft an identity or access different spaces, cultivate a personality, gain access to power or lose power. And all of that is very important when you're talking about cults or cultish groups, as I like to refer to them.
Yeah, I was interested in picking up your book, and I mentioned right before I hit record, like, obviously, with the nature of this show, I've read a lot from Stephen Hassan and, you know, so many like him, like, obviously, you know, also survivors like Sarah Edmondson or Leah Remini. And you know, reading your book was interesting because you are focused specifically on language. Like, that is the subheading of your book, is it's the language of fanaticism. And I realized very quickly, like, language isn't just one part of how cults operate. It's kind of foundational to how they gain any traction whatsoever. So talk to me a little bit about, you know, and for people listening, obviously they should pick up a copy of your book and see the full explanation for this. But how do cults weaponize language to manipulate people and to kind of expand their influence?
Right. Well, first I want to say that in a lot of the cult documentaries, mostly that you'll watch, or, you know, cult media coverage that you'll find, they don't tend to give very satisfying explanations for what causes people to wind up spending years and years and years in these really destructive groups. Mm-hmm. It's all just this vague talk of brainwashing and mind control. But very early on in my research for this book, I learned that brainwashing is nothing but a metaphor. It's not a real or testable phenomenon. It doesn't meet the criteria of the scientific method. You can't prove that brainwashing doesn't exist. It completely discounts people's ability to, you know, think for themselves. And it also can really dehumanize certain people when we think, oh, they were these like mind controlled minions. Yeah. They're completely unlike me. I would never succumb to brainwashing. What's really going on is much more interesting. You don't, you know, cut open someone's brain and scrub it clean. A lot of people who wind up in these groups are incredibly bright and optimistic and service-oriented. They're people who truly believe that solutions to the world's most urgent problems can be found, and that by affiliating with this group or this guru, they can be a part of that change. And in order to manipulate people like that, you need these methods of conversion and conditioning and coercion that have everything to do with language, or at least that's my thesis, which, as you mentioned, language is so foundational. So in the book, I talk about all these different techniques of cultish language, from, you know, special buzzwords and misleading euphemisms to renamings to taking existing English words and twisting them to have a specific and very emotionally charged cult meaning, to thought-terminating cliches. I talk about all these elements of cultish language and how they work not only in notorious groups like Jonestown and Heaven's Gate and Scientology, but also how they show up in groups less, like, further away from the
SoulCycle.
You know, like MLMs and SoulCycle and social media, spiritual influencers, because cultish influence shows up everywhere, and the proof is in the way that we speak.
Right, right. I was thinking, because there's a dorky dad in me that wanted to start the episode saying this episode's brought to you by SoulCycle, but I just, you know, I thought I'd start on a more serious note. But no, I am interested, because when you look at all these different organizations, and your book, what's interesting about it is that, you know, there's there's kind of easy low-hanging fruit to go after, you know, the Jonestown. There is Scientology. There are these things that are clearly, you know, that's a cult, you know? And then, you know, the minute you start talking, and I know this from experience, the minute you start talking about churches being culty, you know, and you start talking about religious organizations or
corporations,
you know, yeah, corporations, CrossFit, you know, all these different things to varying degrees. And CrossFit and Scientology are not equally
of course evil,
you know, depending on who you ask. But with you know, with this topic specifically, it is really interesting seeing that from the range of harmless-ish to actually harmful, they do use the same language, the same phrasing, things like that. How much of this specific use of vocabulary that does condition or coerce people, how much of it is intentional and well thought out? Like, did they sit down and map out, here's how you, you know, for lack of a better word, brainwash somebody or manipulate someone? Or is it just something that people happen to do? A certain type of leader happens to talk this way.
Mm. Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we tend to think of cult leaders like Jim Jones or Marshall Applewhite as these evil geniuses, you know, these like great masterminds. But really, they're mostly just opportunists, and they're following power wherever it comes, however quickly it comes. They don't necessarily have a set ideology or brand in mind when they start out. And that's one of the main reasons why so many of these groups will constantly reinvent themselves and why the ideology will change, because the leader is just, you know, doing whatever is convenient and whatever will grant them the most power. So, you know, even Jonestown, for example, started out with pretty pure intentions. It was an integrationist church, and then it turned darker and more destructive as Jim Jones grew more power hungry and more maniacal and all of those things. But in terms of the language, you know, as I mentioned, like you cannot hope to manipulate someone, much less a group of people, without mastering these language techniques. Jim Jones is someone who is extremely strategic about the way that he used language. He would study the oratory techniques of populist leaders, everyone from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to Hitler. And he would take the most compelling parts of their speech stylings and he would put his own Jonesian twist on them. He was sort of a Machiavellian master of code switching. There were people in the People's Temple, which is the group known as Jonestown, who came from a lot of different walks of life. There were sort of, you know, college educated young white folks living alongside, you know, middle-aged Black women who were active in San Francisco's church scene, Baptist church scene. And he needed different language tactics in his tool belts to appeal to those different groups of people. Now, again, because brainwashing isn't this real or testable phenomenon, he couldn't just like say some kind of magic spell and immediately be able to hook someone who didn't on some level want to be hooked already. So there are a lot of ingrained reasoning flaws that in a way do our own brainwashing for us. A spam phone call from South Korea. Is it because I've been watching Squid Game?
Perfect.
I'll backtrack. You can't, you know, right. So there are these human reasoning flaws that in a way do our brainwashing for us, like confirmation bias. We hear what we want to hear. And there's cognitive dissonance at play when someone is promising us something that we so badly want to believe and using language that cues us to stop thinking or to have a strong emotional reaction. And yet we have this gut instinct that something is amiss. So I think, you know, most destructive cultish leaders are being quite strategic about their language. You can even see that in abusive corporate environments when, one in five CEOs has been determined to have psychopathic tendencies. that's quite culty, not in the same way as, really damaging religious cults, but also, you know, a lot in common, a lot of abuses in common. But yeah, you'll find CEOs who come up with a very specific type of rhetoric, like the CEO of WeWork. If anyone's watched the WeWork documentary on Hulu, he had so many buzzwords and phrases and labels that were meant to divide people into a superior us and an inferior them, chants and mantras that were meant to bond people together and manufacture that sense of solidarity. And those things don't always have to be bad. But it's when, you know, those negative intentions come in and the thought terminating cliches and phrases that are really meant to shut down your independent thinking and sense of individualism are at play in excess that, yeah, you know, you're in a slightly more destructive cult.
Yeah, we've touched on thought terminating cliches a bit, and I definitely want to talk about that because that wrecked my brain really grasping what that was. But before we do that, you mentioned like Jonestown, for example, people from all walks of life and in corporate environments, there's people, all different backgrounds, all different IQ levels, all different social, you know, there's so many different people. And it seems like, you know, when you hear stories of anything from a NXIVM to a Scientology to some of the independent Baptist cults that we talk about on the show, there are people who, for all intents and purposes, shouldn't be sucked into a cult, you know, and I'm doing air quotes as I say that, you know, so someone gets offended by that. But you look at it and go like, they're intelligent or well-educated or this. It seems like there's no class system when it comes to being susceptible to cults. Is there, is there any kind of level on which some are more susceptible than others?
It's really complicated. I mean, there are a lot of things that might contribute to a person being more vulnerable to fraud, scams, et cetera. But it tends to be like the opposite from what people might think. So, you know, prevailing wisdom says that people who wind up in cults are desperate, intellectually deficient, disturbed in some way. But why would a cult want someone like that?
Right.
Cults want winners. They want people of privilege with time and money and connections to spend, to burn. Mm-hmm. They want people who have enough idealism and enthusiasm and resources so that when inevitably the lofty promises that were made don't come true, they're not just going to get the hell out of Dodge. You know, if someone is really down and out financially or, you know, doesn't have anything to their name, they're not going to be able to stick it out in a cultish group for very long. Yeah. They're going to need to start making money for their kids or, you know, they're not going to be able to hang out for very long. Right. And that's why you see so many sort of, you know, upper middle class, college educated, you know, white privileged people being targeted, people who are well connected in their communities. Cults are like recruitment machines, a lot of them anyway. And I'm not just talking about like religious cults. I'm also talking about multi-level marketing cults and spaces like that. But, you know, there's a lot that New Age ideology, which pervades a lot of cultish groups, has in common with like fundamentalist Christian and evangelical ideology. And so certain people who are rejecting the Christianity that they maybe grew up with still find some of that rhetoric familiar when they mm-hmm. hear it in a New Age context. So in New Age groups, there's often talk of being born in trauma, which is not that different from being born in sin. There are the same good, evil binaries that you might hear in certain Christian spaces. There's talk of paradigm shifts and great awakenings, which sound not dissimilar from a second coming or a rapture. And so, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a type of person that these groups tend to target.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And again, like you said, prevailing wisdom would say, oh, it's dumb or easily manipulated or evil people join cults. Right. You know, and that was one of the things, you know, when I interviewed Sarah Evanson and Nippy was talking with them. It's like very motivated in their career, wanting to help people, wanting to, you know, do something good and encourage yeah. other people. You see that in Leah Remini's interviews, too. Like it was this very, like, we are the hope for mankind kind of feel. And you know, and again, intelligent people, very, very intelligent people with no background of any kind of cultish environment whatsoever. It's kind of startling.
Yeah. I mean, you could argue that Hollywood and acting is cultish. But I will say, you know, the number one like fatal flaw I found talking to cult survivor after cult survivor was exactly what you're talking about. This sense of idealism, this overabundance of optimism that they could be part of this hope for mankind, which is what all of these groups promise. Mm-hmm. You know, these groups don't promise something that, you know, you wouldn't want to be a part of, then nobody would want to be a part of it. You know, they promise something like really, really alluring. Then they, of course, they bait and switch you. But what's funny is that like cynicism is something that will like, sure, keep you from, you know, keep you safe from being recruited to one of these groups, but it'll also probably rob you of a lot of the joy of being a human being on Earth. So, you know, toward the end of Cultish, I talk about how when given personality tests, some of history's finest minds, including Carl Sagan, scored off the charts in both conscientiousness and open-mindedness. Hmm. So there was this balance of, you know, you're not so open to every wacky idea that crosses your desk that Carl Sagan, for example, was willing to believe in the 1970s that UFOs had already landed on Earth and were communicating with humans. But he was open to the idea of extraterrestrial life in the 1970s when that was considered like a very edgy woo-woo idea that now, you know, most scientists are on board with, very open to. So it's all about that balance, shocker, like a life lesson. Because, you know, I don't want people to be too paranoid that they're going to like slip and fall into a cult. But you're completely right that it is this sense of dreaminess, maybe even the same dreaminess that could convince a person they might be able to become famous, that could convince a person they might be able to, you know, solve the world's problems.
Right, right. Yeah, it's really interesting. And you kind of touched on a phenomenon that I see a lot, and it makes me very uncomfortable. And actually, so I haven't talked about this on the show. I will, in the release order, talk about this, but I deconverted from Christianity like over the last couple months, and which was an interesting thing because I stepped out of fundamentalism and was like, oh, I'm still a Christian, but I have this. And it was actually, your book was very instrumental in that kind of process, which was interesting and I could talk about for a long time. But it was, you know, coming out of, you know, Christianity and reading, and I've always read for the last several years, I've always read different thoughts, you know, sometimes with the intention of knowing how to overcome certain people's arguments. But I would read Dawkins. I read Dawkins 6 years ago. I would read Hitchens. I would read all of these different, you know, different people. And, you know, what I noticed was I have the same level of uncomfortability with Richard Dawkins that I do with many fundamentalist preachers, because there is this very, I guess, fundamentalist approach to belief. It's mm-hmm. quick to shut down conversation with anyone who would be a theist, quick to shut down a conversation with someone who would believe differently. And his tribe around him, for lack of a better word, is very cultish, you know? Mm-hmm. And I see that with YouTuber, atheist YouTubers, and there is this aura of like fundamentalism just dripping off of it. And as someone who came out of that staunch background, I'm terrified of that. Like, there is this balance in the middle where it's like, there's very smart people that are theists. There's very smart people that are atheists. There's very smart people that are religious. There's some that, you know, are not religious that are also very smart. It's a blend of things. And what I'm noticing is that, you know, people who especially grew up in religious environments, they tend to seem to, you know, go off that deep end and rush to another form of fundamentalism. They'll rush out from fundamentalist Christianity and become the most cultish version of an atheist that you can find.
Definitely. And that sort of speaks to what I was saying before, where you'll often find ex-Christians gravitating toward New Age belief.
Yeah.
And, you know, in fringier religions as well, or like culty compound atmospheres, I one of my favorite sources for the book, this woman named Laura Johnston Cole, who survived Jonestown, she immediately went and joined another sort of like socialist commune called Synanon, which by freak coincidence was the cult where my dad spent his teenage years against his will. These were sort of the seeds that planted my cult fascination because I grew up on my dad's stories of this sort of like promised socialist utopia in the Bay Area where he was forced to move at the age of 14 and left as soon as he could. But yeah, I mean, I think it also really speaks to human nature that we crave community practices, rituals, we crave meaning, we crave answers. And all of that is particularly true during times of crisis in a culture. So in the United States, we tend to see cults spike during times of socio-political turbulence. That's why so many new religious movements cropped up during the late 60s and 70s, time when you had the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War and Kennedy assassinations, you know, all these things left a lot of Americans feeling sort of existentially high and dry, caused them to mistrust institutions that were supposed to provide them with support from the government to traditional religion. Does any of this sound familiar? Yeah. You know, this is a lot of what we're seeing now. And, you know, when an alternative leader comes forward and says, I have the answers, you know, I know who's evil, I know who's good, I have access to a type of transcendent wisdom that I'm willing to impart on you if you do this, this, and this. That's a message that really consistently resonates, particularly with Americans. but we as human beings are also just fundamentally cultish by nature, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're seeing that right now, because as you were talking, I was thinking about COVID, and I was thinking, you know, church is in decline, like church attendance, Christianity is in a decline, but politically, people are becoming much more culty than ever before. And so you do see people flocking to people who claim to have the answers, whether it's answers of how to combat, which I do not want to get into on this episode, but people who want to combat, you know, this is what the cure is. This is what the restriction should be. This is what the restriction shouldn't be. You start getting into all these different levels and people become, you know, ardent followers of whatever so-and-so says, whether that be a Joe Rogan or a Donald Trump, or whether that be a Joe Biden and a Kamala Harris.
For sure.
Or, you know, and it is interesting that's how that plays out, that we seek someone who does have all the answers, and the opportunists have a great open door right there.
Oh, totally. And, you know, social media influencers, I mean, people who may have never been able to command a group of people in person 40 years ago are now able to build an ideological sect of their own online, you know, for better and for worse. There's now a fanatical fringe group for everyone, an ideological camp for everyone. But also think about how the lines separating political figure, spiritual leader, celebrity, friend, self-help guru, these lines have become incredibly blurry as of late. You know, like Elon Musk comes to mind. He's someone who is a business leader, and he would have been like in that category a few decades ago. But he's not just a business leader. He's also now a celebrity and an influencer. I mean, he freaking hosted SNL, a political figure. He is almost a spiritual figure. I mean, he's literally trying to fly people to another planet, like start a new colony. So, yeah,
but at least he actually has rockets. Okay. At least there's actual rockets.
No, that's true. No, that's quite true. Yes, yes. But yeah, I mean, the lines are really blurry, separating like one type of leader from another. And I even see that from my own like small but engaged social media following. People come to me for answers to things that I absolutely do not have and want, and they want me to have them. And I don't have the energy to start my own cult. So I'm just like, I don't know, man.
That's so funny. That's something that's happened with this show over the last 2 years has been, people, it makes me uncomfortable because I see some people behaving in a cultish way surrounding the show or around the topic. And I'm like, I'm not the leader of a thing. Like, I like, and it's funny because and you know this as an author and somebody who's trying to get their name out too and doing your show, in some level you are, but also, you know, not to steal Tony Robbins, who's, you know, his other thing, but I'm not your guru, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I don't have the answers. And it seems like people, a vast majority of people are uncomfortable with the uncomfortableness of let's figure it out. Like, right, we don't have to have an instant answer, you know, and that's something that really was frustrating for me growing up in fundamentalism is like, everybody was so quick to black and white answers. And if it didn't click for me, I couldn't just be like, oh yeah, we'll just go with that. You know, like it had to be this questioning process. And a lot of people just seem uncomfortable with that for some reason.
Totally. I mean, that's red flag number one. Like anything legitimate will stand up to scrutiny, but a cultish leader doesn't allow questioning or dissent. That's where those thought terminating cliches come in, which we've been dancing around. Yeah. I might as well explain.
let's dance right into that, because I think this for me, thought terminating cliches, and I'm pretty sure Stephen Hassan talks about it in his book, but the way you explained it, like I kept rewinding, I listened to the audiobook, I kept rewinding it and like listening to it and going like, oh my God, like everything everybody says is a thought terminating cliche. I was like, start playing through political rhetoric and religious things. And so, yeah, definitely define what that is. And let's kind of talk about functionally what that looks like, because it kind of speaks to, you know, things should be able to hold up to scrutiny, right? And so when we see now in the age of the internet, like people should be able to Google Scientology is a cult, but people are still getting sucked into Scientology. People should be able to tell some of the fundamentalist, you know, teachings aren't accurate. They should be able to Google that and figure that out. How do thought terminating cliches kind of stop those thoughts dead in their tracks?
Right. Okay. So a thought terminating cliche, this is a term that was coined in the early 60s by a psychologist named Robert J. Lifton, and it describes a sort of stock expression that is easily memorized, easily repeated, and aimed at shutting down independent thinking or questioning. So as we've mentioned, questioning is the enemy to any cultish group. You need people to fall in line. You need to silence people whenever they try to express pushback or point out a wrinkle in the flawed system that is this cult. And thought terminating cliche will do just that. It will cause someone to, you know, put their own cognitive dissonance to bed for a little while. So in a new age group, you've been mentioning Sarah Nippy. So in a group like Nexium, a thought terminating cliche might sound something like dismissing a valid fear or anxiety as a limiting belief, mm-hmm, or saying, well, don't let yourself be ruled by fear. But thought terminating cliches also show up, oh my gosh, in so many spaces, political spaces, and in our everyday lives. I mean, things like it is what it is, boys will be boys, it's all in God's plan. Those are all thought terminating cliches, and they halt a conversation from moving forward. Now, again, you know, in terms of like all the information you would ever want to know about Scientology is already out there. Like, why do people join anyway? I mean, people do what they want to do. Yeah. And there are always going to be power abusive people who are taking advantage of others' idealism, vulnerability in one way or another. And, you know, this language is so powerful that you could, you know, Google Scientology to your heart's content, although that's not even allowed in Scientology. That's called black PR and you're not supposed to look at it. But, you know, you can get all of the internet's wealth of information. And yet, if you want so badly to believe that this group has the answers and that all of that is just black PR and all of that is just these naysayers who are like threatened by the leader at the top, if you want to believe that, then you just will. Like, right, the human mind, you are your own cult leader in a way.
Well, you start telling yourself the thought terminating cliches. You know, that was something that, you know, I look back at fundamentalist, you know, the sect that I was in, you know, and I'm always hesitant saying it's a cult for one of the reasons you mentioned in your book, which is that is a, you know, that is that semantic stop sign. It's a thought terminating cliche, ends the conversation. It's like telling someone you're brainwashed, like good luck convincing them of anything at that point. But, you know, growing up within it, you know, there were things where if anything negative was said, I remember very clearly, this was one of the things that kind of made my brain just explode, you know, reading your book, was I started thinking through all the ones I'd heard over the years, you know, you know, when I mentioned there was a documentary that came out from 2020 exposing abuse within the independent Baptist world. And I remember one of the lawyers that works in the environment stood up at a conference and said, you know, you guys don't even need to watch it. It's a satanic attack full of lies, you know? And it's like, he shut down the chance that there could be anything valid within that before it even reached us, you know? You had, when something didn't make sense, you had a question. God works in mysterious ways, you know? If you had an issue with abuse happening, in 11th grade, you know, I was pointing out that there was a sexual predator in the pulpit. And it was like, you need to forgive. You're just bitter. If you didn't get something from the message, it wasn't helping you. Your heart's not right. There were so many that were just second nature. And it's actually one of the things that really, there were a lot of things, but that's one of the things when it came to Christianity is I noticed the Bible actually is full of thought-terminating cliches, which I know is going to be a very controversial thing for me to say, but
They're useful for religion because, like, you know, religion is not science. It's a faith-based thing. Like, it requires you to suspend your disbelief in a lot of ways. And there's always going to be wrinkles. Like, there are always going to be things that don't make sense. Mm-hmm. And you're going to need a thought-terminating cliche to get someone to, like, stop thinking about that. Yeah. Like, don't think about it too hard is the ultimate thought-terminating cliche, and it's used all the time. Like, you know, we were talking about, it's like the word cult is incredibly charged. Mm-hmm. It's sensational. It's unspecific. What even is a cult? Like, you know, what is the difference between religion and cult? Like, it's so subjective. But it's also very difficult to define religion. Like, scholars have been arguing for so long about what a religion even is.
Yeah, yeah. It's, yeah. And like I said, there's so many, I mean, you know, God's ways are not your ways. God's thoughts are not your thoughts. God works mysterious ways. There's a lot that shut down those kind of things. But also, I am curious on the religious versus cult side, because to me, I mean, Stephen Hassan, I think, gives a good explanation. Religions that show what they believe on the surface and show you up front what they're about can be healthy, because you can, again, and also we don't know, you know, there's some things we don't know. Was there design? Was it accident? You know, like, there's, people are going to debate that forever. But you know, the thing is, you have to reveal what you're about before you suck somebody in. But I am curious to know your perspective on that. Like, when you look at religions and cults, the lines are also very blurred sometimes. So blurry. You know, you look at evangelical Christianity right now, even people who are evangelical Christians are going like, this feels kind of culty. Some of the stuff happening in the Southern Baptist Convention feels culty. What is the distinguishing, you know, line between a cult and a religious group in your mind?
I mean, it's going to be different depending on who you talk to. Yeah. There are lists of criteria that people have tried to come up with, you know, is something a cult when there's an us versus them mentality, and ends justify the means philosophy, supernatural beliefs, charismatic leaders, grave exit costs. But you have good on that list, and there will be plenty of, like, fringy groups that have been or could be called cults that won't check off every box. And yet you will often find mainstream religions and other kinds of groups, Silicon Valley corporations, that will check off every box. You know, so many accepted religions in the United States were once considered blasphemous cults, including the Quakers, who are just about, like, the most peaceful people ever. There's this, you know, classic quote in religious studies that cult plus time equals religion. It's just, you know, in a way, a cult that everybody accepts. I mean, like, Jesus was just a cult leader at that time, right? Like, he was this guy who emerged and everybody was like, who is this dude who, like, thinks he knows everything? So it is incredibly nebulous. But what I can say is that the word cults is not enough to be able to determine if a group is dangerous. You need to look more closely than that. And the word cult just simply has no hard and fast definition. I mean, there are a lot of religious scholars and sociologists and psychologists that I talk to for my book who don't even use it formally.
Well, it's become so much of a negative connotation. You know what I mean? Like, even, you know, it would get a lot of clicks as an episode title, but, you know, Jesus was a cult leader. I think people would say, well, he's not like Charles Manson. It's like, it doesn't mean they're inherently evil. what it means is they had a small follow. That's what a cult is, a small radical following of people.
That's right. I mean, that- in cultish, I chart the etymology and history of the word cult, and the word itself did not always have negative connotations. The word, earliest version of the word cult can be found centuries ago. It had a very innocent meaning. It simply meant homage paid to divinity or offerings made to win over the gods. Over the next few hundred years, it evolved to mean just like simply another kind of churchly classification, like religion, sect, cult. By the mid 20th century, it had evolved to mean something kind of dark because the emergence of new religions during that time sort of frightened some old school Christians, and they wanted to, you know, demonize some of those groups. So cults became associated with like charlatans and kooks and con artists, but
and the Manson still, murders and satanic panic, you know.
So then in the 60s and 70s, you had the widely, you know, media covered Manson murders and the Jonestown massacre. And not until then was cult really put on the map as something that every American should know about and fear. And then, of course, as soon as cults became scary, they also became cool. And that's why we have phrases like cult followed and cult classic and whatever.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I'm curious about the perspective of, you know, the cult side. So obviously very in danger, very in, you know, there's some cults that aren't necessarily even unhealthy, you know, very passionate groups of people bonding over something, you know, things like that. But speaking specifically to negative cultish groups, and my show specifically, I deal with people who've experienced physical abuse, sexual abuse, mental manipulation, financial, you know, manipulation, giving entire paychecks when they can't pay rent to the church, you know, things like that. You know, how does that happen? I mean, you mentioned your book, conditioning, so learned behavior in response to a stimulus, which I would say we're always being conditioned by any piece of marketing or anything, but specifically coercion is interesting to me. And that us versus them mentality, you know, can you kind of break that down? Like, why is it so important for cultish leaders to separate people from everyone else in order to be able to abuse and manipulate? And why don't people who are in it leave? That's the question that always comes up. If you notice you're in an area where you're losing your money, your family's falling apart, why don't you leave? How do they set that up?
Right. So in the beginning, you'll be what's called love bombs, which I'm sure has been brought up before on your show, or people that have heard of it, where you'll
we've all experienced it.
Yes, so, or you've all experienced it. You'll be showered with this love and attention and promises that you're special and you can access this wisdom and you can be a part of this movement. You know, you are loved, like you are amazing. And that feels really good. Like, who doesn't want all of that to be true? That's, you know, gonna provoke a really intense conversion event. And there are other techniques that can cause a really intense conversion event, that like moment when all of a sudden you need to be a part of this group and your life is no longer the same. All kinds of things. In some fundamentalist Christian groups, they'll have you engage in like a speaking in tongues or a glossolalia practice. There are so many techniques. And then, you know, slowly but surely, they will bait and switch you. Like, they will go back on these promises that were made, and they will use this superior status that they've given you with maybe a special name and, you know, buzzwords that you've been taught that nobody else can understand. They will use your superior status as an excuse to mistreat you. Mm-hmm. They will, you know, paint this portrait of everyone on the outside as, you know, fundamentally depraved. All of these people have succumbed to a Luciferian program. You know, they'll use all these like really loaded words to make anything on the outside seem like you absolutely on no level can leave. But if you absolutely on no level can leave, then they can do anything they want to you, and they can force you to do anything. And you will, if you want to stay, find a way to stay, and they'll give you every reason to want to stay. And sometimes they, you know, make it physically very difficult to leave, financially very difficult to leave. And so those are some of the reasons why you might stay, in combination with, you know, another human ingrained reasoning flaw, like the sunk cost fallacy, which is this bias that tells us, you know, the longer we've spent somewhere, the more we've invested in something, the more that justifies spending even more time, money, energy, love. But the reasons why someone might not leave after years and years can be compared to why someone might not get out of an abusive one-on-one relationship. You know, it's easy to victim blame, but who can't think of an incredibly like charismatic, smart person who's spent too many years in a toxic one-on-one relationship, whether that was a lover or a job or whatever it is. You know, you might not have anywhere else to go. You might not have the means. You might, you know, be afraid that no one will ever love you like this person. There are so many reasons to stay that really speak to the human condition and the human spirit. And, you know, like, no, it's not logical to stay, but like, human beings don't make decisions about everything in their life based on like pros and cons lists. Like, we're all just these like fleshy humans operating on instinct and emotion, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's, I heard someone in a sales thing one time say that people make decisions based on emotion. They justify with logic. And, you know, that's what you see happen so often with abusive relationships, or in this instance, in abusive organizations. And I really loved in your book, you talked about, well, it's a direct quote. It says, when you convince someone that they're above everyone else, it helps you both distance them from outsiders and also abuse them, because you can paint anything from physical assault to unpaid labor to verbal attacks as a special treatment reserved only for them. And to me, that was very early on in your book. And that was where I was like, my brain kicked into like, okay, I need to really, really, really pay attention, because there was so much in that statement. You know, you talk about being separated, like, growing up, it was, you're either in the church or you're in the world, you know, there's the worldly influences, you know, the terms you got called, you know, it was like your brother so-and-so, or the name of my show is Preacher Boys, because young men in the movement were called Preacher Boys. Like, they got to throw on their suit and get their Bible, and like, they were kind of like the people they got pointed to from the pulpit and said, you're doing great, like, you're the best. And then also too, like, the abuse, like, literally everything in that sentence, you know, unpaid labor, physical assault, verbal attacks, that's all things that were very commonplace. And, you know, again, those thought term and cliches come out of like, oh, you know, God tests those that he loves. And like, you know, you have to live like no one else, you know, so you can someday get your crown in heaven and all these different things. It was so manipulative. And the reason that you didn't leave was, yes, the sunk cost fallacy was huge. I know for me, it's like your relationships, your politics, your everything is in that world. Your finances are tied up in that world. What are you going to do? You know, if you've, and for many people, I'm lucky I skipped the Christian college route. Many of the people on my show went to 4 years of college and paid for a degree that is not worth anything. So you go layer after layer, and this is where your book, I think, is important. And I think Stephen Hassan's book is important. I think listening to, you know, like your podcast or like Sarah's podcast, is it gives you a lot of empathy for people, because especially your book, you're reading through all the different things people get wrapped up in. There's nobody that could pick up that book that could say, oh, I wasn't part of something like this, you know, like,
yeah,
there's,
and implicating us all.
Yeah. We're all in this position where we get drawn to these idealistic versions of the world that just don't exist. And I guess, you know, as we kind of get near the end, you know, again, we're all susceptible. We know that. What are the best ways people can be on the lookout and protect themselves from becoming part of a vulnerable kind of situation?
Right. I mean, I don't want to encourage people to be too cynical or too wary, because again, that can spoil some of the most like enchanting fun parts of being a human. I don't discourage anyone from involving themselves in spiritual practices, woo-woo practices, even like fringy practices. But it's about being able to tap in and tap out. Like you need to be able to return at the end of the hour or day or whatever it is to an identity that is more complex than this one ideology, this one group, this one guru. And if you're not able to do that, then that's a red flag. Like you need to be able to strip off that linguistic uniform at a point. And if, you know, the language that you're using all day, every day causes you to, you know, morally divorce yourself from some one-dimensionally inferior other, causes you to, you know, have a strong emotional response, but stop asking questions. That's a sign that that, you know, that type of language is worth questioning. And it's hard because it feels really good to speak, you know, a special code language that makes you feel like you're doing something right in the world. But at the end of the day, it's probably better to be a member of multiple different cults and participate casually and to make room in your brain for nuance. Because that's really where the protection of your identity really exists.
Well, there you go, guys. Join multiple cults. that's your advice. No, I think that's helpful. And I think the short version too is I think just educate yourself, you know, just like, you know, it is a responsibility of organizations and people to educate you on who they are and be honest, but you can't always rely on that. So you have to be able to spot the red flags. And I do think, I think your short answer is buy your book, because I think reading, reading Cultish really, for everybody listening, it will point out, I mean, seriously, like trying to listen to political discourse or religious conversations and debates after reading your book is very difficult. And I think that's a, good thing. And I think it's important for people to be able to spot those red flags that, you know, cult leaders aren't usually going to show you right out of the gate. So that's awesome. And I really appreciate you coming on the show. I want to give you a second to talk about your podcast, your book Cultish, which I've mentioned and people should definitely check out in the show notes. But what are some of the things you're working on and what's the best place for people to connect with you?
Sure. Well, you can follow me on Instagram if you want to join my little cult at Amanda_Montel. My book Cultish is available in hardback, ebook, and audiobook wherever you buy books. And I have a podcast called Sounds Like a Cult about the modern day cults we all follow, where every week my co-host and I pick a different fanatical group from the zeitgeist, from SoulCycle to Tony Robbins to fraternities and sororities to Trader Joe's, to try to determine this thing sounds like a cult, but is it really? And if so, is it a live your life, a watch your back, or a get the fuck out level cult?
Right. Well, thank you so much for jumping on. And seriously, guys, check out the podcast, the book. It's amazing. I know I've talked about it ad nauseum, just in my group, in my own little cult. But it's phenomenal. And I really appreciate you sharing your perspectives.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Additional information can always be found on PreacherBoysDoc.com.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. To serve others in ways that promote human flourishing and create a ripple effect of transformation for generations to come. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.